Welcome to Inside Investing. We're here at CLSA, and we have Mike Mayo from CLSA and Robert Stammers of the CFA Institute. And Mike, you bought 100 shares of four companies that you cover, and you've noted that as an individual investor attending shareholder meetings, you have better access than you had as a sell-side analyst. What is going on there? Can you unpack that a bit for us?
How about that? I've been doing this job for 25 years, and not once had I ever met a director of one of the banks that I've covered.
Seriously?
So this is the first time I said, wait a minute, we have management team after management team after management team, sometimes making repeated mistakes. So who's overseeing the management teams? It's the directors. How do I get to talk to a director? Well, I have to own shares. So I got all the special approvals. I bought stock in four large banks so I could attend their annual meetings. So after 25 years, I attended my first annual meetings in the year 2013.
That's unreal. So who usually goes to these?
Well, I told people I was going to the annual meetings, and people would say, nobody goes to those meetings, they're a bunch of crackpots, nothing gets done, they're a relic of a half a century ago. So people have this image of a bunch of senior citizens going there for the free food. Well, of all ironies, I just got my AARP card in the mail, so maybe, you know, what are you going to do now? I guess I'll go to annual meetings. But that, I decided, was my one chance. You have a chance once a year to ask questions of corporate directors, and I was going to take that opportunity. So I bought my 100 shares of stock in four large banks, and I went to the J.P. Morgan annual meeting down in Tampa, Florida. I went to the Morgan Stanley annual meeting up in Purchase, New York. I went to the KeyCorp annual meeting. That's a regional bank in Cleveland, Ohio. And then I went to the Citigroup annual meeting right here in Midtown Manhattan.
I mean, if you don't go to these meetings as an investor, how do you ascertain managerial risk? I mean, there's ways to get to it, but it must be much more apparent at these meetings, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of the people that are managing the business.
Well, as an institutional investor, as a Wall Street analyst, there is a certain degree of access to management. That would be the CEO, the CFO, people who run the major business lines. There's sometimes investor days. There's conference calls. So there's wide access to management in a general sense. In a specific sense, and I've written about this in my book, I don't always get the access to the CEO or CFO. And almost always, you don't have any access to the directors of the company. So you can ascertain management, the day-to-day managers, but you never have access, almost never, to the people overseeing the managers. And that's what I said, hey, let's bring this game to a new level.
Yeah, and this is in an area, you cover banking stocks here. This is an area that's widely, it's a paragon of corporate governance, as I understand it. Is that correct? Probably not.
Well, it's well documented through the financial crisis, the problems of the financial industry, and we can talk more later, but just take a look at Citigroup last decade. They had the absolute worst stock price performance among the largest banks, and the CEOs got paid more than any other CEOs. That's not what I learned in CFA. That's not pay for performance. And so some of my questions were, in the case of Morgan Stanley, I went to their annual meeting, and I was the only person from Wall Street, institutional investors. You know, those critics were correct. Nobody goes there. Well, that was fantastic. It was like a gold mine for me if you're doing research. And my basic question was, management has financial targets, but they have no time frame to achieve those financial targets. So how are you going to hold management accountable? It's not rocket science. And of all things, well, first the CEO answers the question with kind of a non-answer. And I go, with all due respect, sir, I came here to Purchase, New York, not to talk to the CEO or management, who I have access to, thank you very much, but to talk to the directors who oversee management. So after a little bit of back and forth, they said, we expect to achieve our financial targets in the year 2014. And I said, thank you. But while I said thank you, in my head, it was a three-alarm fire. It was phenomenal. Here it is. And this was webcast. It was Reg FD compliant. Mm-hmm. So I got to my office later that day. I increased my estimates. I called the large investors who are my clients. And over the next week, the stock was up, you know, almost 10%, outperforming the banks in the market. And so people think of annual meetings. People go there asking questions as, you know, do-gooders. You know, we have some political view or we have some other agenda. My agenda is to be the best representation of the investors and make them money. But not only do I think can you make investors money by going to annual meetings, as I started doing this year, but I also think this allows you to hold management more accountable. So now in the case of Morgan Stanley, when I go back next year or the year after and I say you haven't achieved your financial targets, if that's the case, then I can go to the directors, so what are you going to do about it? So that was a true success story all around. I think it makes Morgan Stanley look better by having more concrete targets. And so that was just one of a few examples this season. In the case of Citigroup, that's where you have a lot of people. And that's kind of more of a show. And I say a show because as you walked into the annual meeting, they had a consumer service booth. If you have a consumer problem, that's who you're supposed to talk to. Because apparently at Citigroup's annual meeting or other bank annual meetings, you have people show up with customer service issues.
Yeah, with customer problems.
You get some mortgage notice or credit card notice, and you know, let's not waste everybody's time.
And their shareholders, so they come to the shareholders as well. Right?
Exactly, the shareholders are there too. But you have some shareholders who go to these meetings and ask questions that wouldn't be considered so germane to an investor with the CFA, such as explain why I have more shares of stock, but the price per share is, you know, just basic mathematical questions. So I'd say half the questions weren't really topics that I so care about. But on the other hand, other questions were like, you know, why don't you change the configuration of your bank before regulators force you to do so? And the tone in which some of the questions were asked by individual investors or some investors overseeing some smaller size of funds, they got extremely aggressive saying, you know, why do you have your meeting in Dallas last year? This is Citigroup. Why didn't you have it in New York City? Why are the directors sitting with their backs to the audience? Like, holy cow. It really, you know, I have a reputation for being aggressive, which I just think I'm doing my job. I don't consider myself aggressive or not aggressive. I just try to ask the obvious questions. But compared to these aggressive questioners at the Citigroup annual meeting, I look like a wallflower. So that was interesting. But, you know, another concern at Citigroup today, and I know we'll talk more about it, was how does the chairman get along with the CEO since they're different people, right? That's one big debate in governance circles. But seeing these two people in action, sharing the questions, their body language, I mean, they looked like Sonny and Cher. Well, for the old-timers out there, you remember Sonny and Cher. But they seemed completely relaxed. And unless I went there in person, I would not have seen that at anywhere else. So that was helpful to go to the Citigroup annual meeting. And then I have similar stories having gone down to the J.P. Morgan and the KeyCorp annual meeting. So I started with four annual meetings. I plan to repeat this again next year, hopefully on a wider scale.
On a wider base. So is this the sort of thing where all investors, even individual investors, should contemplate going to the meetings of the companies that they own or cover? Or is it something where they can just read Mike Mayo's reportage and then be well off, or sort of seek good independent sell-side analysis or good independent analysts?
I think this might be a waste of time for individual investors, unless if it's in your region. It's interesting, but it's played as a loser's game by the companies. In fact, I remember my CFA studies in the late 1980s, they had an essay about a loser's game and how investing is really about not messing up as opposed to hitting a bunch of winners. And I use that phrase when I play sports sometimes, so it's great. I loved it for the CFA. But I think the companies play this as a loser's game. Give as much give as little information as possible, and don't take any risks, and let's just get through this meeting without any incident.
Gotcha.
And so that's the real downside, I think, for people going there. It is sometimes boring. If I didn't go to some of these meetings, it would have been really boring. It just so happened that there were hardly any other questions. I asked almost all the questions at a couple of those annual meetings, and I got answers. So it wound up being valuable just because I got answers to my own questions. But for the average person, and as far as the Wall Street analyst, it's a different way of doing analysis. Again, I think this is the way CFA teaches one to do analysis, like go to management and hold their feet to the fire, hold them accountable. Unfortunately, that's still not the way a lot of analysis is done on Wall Street. I mean, look no further than the number of sell ratings on Wall Street. I mean, 5% of all ratings on Wall Street are sell. That's not what CFA taught me. But I think that's simply a microcosm of a broader attitude is let's not rock the boat too much, let's talk to management, let's repeat their strategy, let's have our earnings forecast, let's play it safe. So unfortunately, we still have a long way to evolve. I think CFA has helped lead the way. But, you know, if you're only going to have 5% of ratings that are sell, how many analysts are actually going to go to annual meetings asking probing questions of directors? It doesn't necessarily get you in their good graces to do so. So I don't have high expectations that many people are going to follow my footsteps. I think to the extent that I make investors money, which certainly is so far, I mean, it's early days as far as just a few months since these annual meetings, but I think it has the potential to make a difference. If you get one or two more following these footsteps, perhaps in other industries, I wouldn't mind that being one of my legacies.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to take anyone serious if they're not going to make some sell-side recommendations, right? I mean, if they're always going to be buy or hold, I mean, it's very hard to take anyone serious over the long term.
Yeah, everything can't outperform. So Bob Stammers, if individual investors shouldn't be going to these annual meetings all the time, how should they be keeping track of their holdings
over
time?
Well, like Meg said, I mean, there's other opportunities for them to get information, whether it's through the conference calls that the companies do, whether it's the letters and the information that the company puts out. That's probably at the level that individual investors need to be trying to get information. Like Mike said, it's more about understanding what the company is doing and coming up with a decent valuation and understanding where the business is moving and it has the ability to increase revenues than, you know, what's happening day to day. I mean, if they're comfortable with the managerial and the governance risk, then they're probably all right. If they see something that they don't like, then obviously they need to act on it. But in most cases, it's not going to be the shareholder meeting that's going to give them, you know, that ability to determine whether, you know, management is, you know, strong or weak.
Gotcha. So, you know, Mike, at one point you included a disclaimer in your research reports. This is before you started going to shareholder meetings, where you said, you know, I haven't really been able to get anybody on the other side of anybody at this company to pick up the phone for quite a long time. Can you talk about that, what that experience was like, just sort of trying to get to this particular company, which we'll get to in more detail in a second?
Well, I want me to name the company?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay. And that company is Citigroup, of all things. And frankly, just one more comment on the shareholder meetings. I mean, Will, we were talking earlier, and you said the shareholder activism that I've been doing, and other people say shareholder activism. I actually see it as shareholder duty. Mm-hmm. If you're a Wall Street analyst, not an individual investor, if you're a Wall Street analyst and you're representing other people's money, I think it's your duty to stay on top of a company. And if I don't have access over the years to a company like Citigroup, well, then I'm certainly going to ask questions of the directors. They have a terrible record. So that was exactly what happened to me at Citigroup going back to 2002 when you had the king dealmaker, Sandy Weill, buying companies and putting them together, what today is called Citigroup, and I wasn't allowed in for a meeting. And they told me that, and I wasn't allowed to ask questions on the quarterly analyst conference calls where all my peers get to ask questions. I don't care. Don't allow anyone to ask questions. I'm fine with that. But if you allow someone to play, you know, if you play golf, if you're allowed a driver as part of your golf clubs, and I'm not allowed any woods and only a putter and a six iron, that's not fair.
Yeah.
And I just want a level playing field. So that happened in 2002. And of all ironies, it happened after I testified to Congress about Wall Street's conflicts of interest. So you can testify to Congress and you still don't get access. Wow. But then history repeated itself, because then the financial crisis came, and I had published 10,000 pages of research for the decade before the financial crisis talking about the problem with the banking industry, including Citigroup. I put a sell rating on Citigroup before the crisis. The stock declines. I testified to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, so I'm very proud of that. You had the four large bank CEOs testify, and I was the fifth person to testify on the cause of the financial crisis. So I did the research, the stocks tanked, I testified on the causes, and then you know what happened? Citigroup cut me off. They wouldn't allow me in to go meet with management. And I go, what's up with this? So finally, after having done everything I thought I could, I wrote my independent, sometimes critical research. I testified to Congress. I wrote a book about the problems at Citigroup. And then I went to the press and just said, they won't let me in. And so eventually they let me in. I had to use the press. I deliberately did so, but only to get public opinion awareness out there, saying this is not fair. This is what caused the financial crisis. Faulty incentives. All right, they shouldn't be incentivized to cut off analysts who are just trying to tell you the truth. And that it was still taking place after the financial crisis is horrendous. I still can't believe it, that that's what took place. But so I had my disclaimer report as far back as 2002. History repeated itself. Like, wow, that really could take place. You know, people were still talking about the cause of the financial crisis, and I said, hey, take a look at what's happening today.
Yeah. Really, you know, and that gets into a quote. I mean, you call Citigroup the Zelig of economic history, in reference, of course, the classic Woody Allen movie where he plays his character Zelig, who shows up at every important moment of recent history. There's a great quote, which, I mean, so you say, you know, there's a tendency in this industry, and I think among all investors, to latch onto one specific asset or strategy that seems to be working and plow resources into it until the enterprise collapses. And Bob, that sounds like a pretty classic behavioral finance kind of thing.
It is. I mean, if you see, I mean, it's the herd mentality, right? Everyone sees something that's working and they move towards it until you get an asset bubble and then it crashes, right? I mean, we've seen it happen in so many different assets over the years, you know? Just see recently in real estate, I mean, with the real estate crisis. So it's exactly that.
Yeah.
And so as, you know, I look at Citigroup, I've covered Citigroup for a couple of decades as a Wall Street analyst, and for my book, Exile on Wall Street, I went back and looked for the last 200 years, because that's how long Citigroup's been around, but for the last 100 years, Citigroup would have failed 6 times if not for some degree of government intervention. So you go back after World War I, when sugar prices were booming, Citigroup went ahead and lent an amount equal to 80% of their capital to all sorts of Cuban mills and merchants. And then guess what happened? Sugar prices tanked and Citigroup almost failed. And then you had the stock market crash of 1929, the banking crisis. I guess they weren't alone then. Then you had 1970, this company called Penn Central, a railroad company. And once again, Citigroup had a lot of debt there, and the commercial paper market froze. 1982, Citigroup had a lot of money lent to what was then called lesser developed countries, today called emerging markets. Citigroup had over 80% of its capital lent just to Brazil. And that's when the CEO of the time said that countries don't go broke. Yeah, but they can cause the banks to go broke. And then the early 1990s, commercial real estate, and Bob, as you just mentioned, the recent housing crisis. So, Citi, if there's been a problem in the banking industry, Citi has been there for the last 100 years.
But Mike, you have a buy on the stock.
I do. Uh-oh. How's that for confidence? Actually, I'm very confident now. I mean, the stock is down 90% from where it was before the crisis or in early 2007. So cheap prices certainly get someone's attention. But most importantly here was the change in top management. And I wrote about this going back to when Citigroup was created in its current form in 1998. In fact, I coined the phrase back then, Noah's Ark, because when they first had the merger, it was Citicorp and Travelers, they had, you know, two CEOs and two heads of investment banking and two heads of other areas. So I called it Noah's Ark. They brought two of everybody along. And then since then, they didn't have good oversight by the board, and the stuff they got away with, I wrote about it, didn't matter. And then finally, the CEO last year, they had a few CEOs, but the CEO last year, in my view, got fired, which was exactly the way the system's supposed to work. Why does it have to be such a dramatic event when a CEO gets fired? I mean, people get fired every day at Citigroup. And the CEO, I didn't think, was doing a very good job. The stock price performance under the CEO relative to other bank stocks had not performed well. And so the new chairman, along with the board, decided it was a time for a different CEO. And with that change came a change in a tone at the top. So a leading indicator for going from value destruction to value creation can sometimes be a change in CEO. And I thought in this case, that is what was going to happen. And since then, they have new financial targets, which are much more reasonable. They have a new incentive compensation plan. And management repeatedly says, we're giving you numbers so you can hold us accountable, and we expect to be held accountable. I love it when the CEO says, hold us accountable, because I almost never heard that in the prior decade.
I think a good question, though, to go back to Will's question before about how individual investors, you know, how do they ascertain when management is doing well or if they have a good plan. I mean, in this case, most individual investors, when they see a change in management, the first thing is fear, right? Because they don't know what's going to happen. So what do you think, what should someone do in that case on the individual side? I mean, do they go to you or to go to the sell-side analyst and say, well, what are they thinking about this particular company, or where else can they turn?
Well, I think the benefit of a Wall Street analyst is you have continuity of coverage with the company. So I know the history of Citigroup. But if you said, hey, just give me one indicator, well, was the company very successful or unsuccessful? And if it's been a very unsuccessful company like Citigroup and you're changing CEOs, it has the potential to be good. Doesn't mean it is good, but in my view, it's the potential to be good. So a positive catalyst. Likewise, it's a tough act to follow a very, you know, kind of star-like CEO who succeeded in the past. In fact, I'm sure we can run more rigorous studies of this, you know, going from a star CEO to a lesser-known CEO. I'm just guessing it. The guy who follows, the man or woman who follows that person probably doesn't do quite as well. It's just a hunch.
Mm-hmm. Something you know, but you can't prove.
I'm sure we
could prove eventually.
We certainly could. And something else, this is what I teach to anyone who's new to my team, but it's also true for individual investors who want to just take 10 minutes out of their time. And you think about it, you're putting a lot of your own savings on the line sometimes with these investments, and you need a little more than just talking to the taxi driver here in New York City or, you know, someone at a school event. It's just read the first 4 pages of the annual report. It's online. It's easier than the old days. You just type in there, in the case of, you know, Citigroup annual report, and it'll pop up in about, you know, 3 seconds. And you just look at the 4 pages, or 5 or 6 pages, that's the CEO letter, the chairman letter.
Right.
And I find reading that, and if you really want to just go back the last 5 years and read those 4 pages, 20 pages of reading, and you'll get a sense. You do that a little bit, you're going to start getting a feel for, okay, who seems to, you know, talk in terms that you understand. That's certainly one thing I've realized in my 25 years. If I don't understand what a company is telling me, it's not my fault. And for an individual investor, it's hard to get that level of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, just go read a couple other annual reports and you say, which one do I understand? Which one makes sense to me? Because if they haven't communicated it in a way that an individual investor can understand, it might mean they don't understand it enough, they're not synchronized enough, they haven't really thought it through as much as they should.
That's a really great point, because that's one of the things that we've been talking about. I mean, CFA Institute right now is undergoing this Future of Finance project, you may be aware of it, where they're trying to get the industry to come together to create a more, you know, transparent and equitable markets for for the end investor. But one of the things we talk about is the responsibility of investors too, and one of those things is to kind of is to understand the companies you're invested in, right? And a lot of them just don't. A lot of them don't go, at least take the time that you're talking about, is just read the annual report or just read the information that's available to them to get an understanding if they get a confidence level with the assets they're invested in.
Or at least to understand your financial advisor. I mean, I'm biased, but a financial advisor with a CFA designation, I put on a higher pedestal than one without a CFA designation. At least we have, you know, rigorous ethical standards.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, you know, well, in either case, then you still need to understand, have enough information to take to your investment advisor, right? And then we talk about the things that you can, you know, those things that you can control. And one of them certainly is, you know, who do you hire to be your financial advisor? How do you evaluate their performance? How do you evaluate the fees that you're paying? These are all things that, in addition to understanding the assets that you're invested in, the products you're invested in, is to understand the person that's giving you advice. So I think that's a very good point.
But, Bob, I certainly do agree in that discussion with your financial advisor, if you're going that route, to discuss some of the holdings that the financial advisor has put you in. Like, you own this company called Citigroup. And you own this company called Morgan Stanley. And how do they work, and how do you get comfortable with that and to have some basic knowledge? Never hurts. I mean, if you're talking about your house, a major purchase, or even a car, a lot of people know a lot more about their car than they do about their investments.
Absolutely.
And their investments can be like many multiples, you know, higher in terms of investment dollars or money spent than their car.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. Some basic knowledge can go a long way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and at least, you know, the car analogy, you know, to some minds, a lot less complicated than the car.
Well, I think that's one of the issues. You went back to you're talking about behavioral finance, and that's one of the issues. A lot of people are scared of investments. They don't think they can understand it. And so even with their advisors, sometimes they're you know, they're not confident about, you know, speaking up and saying what they do know or what they don't know. And sometimes that will keep them from asking the right questions. But
you know what I think I've done that's helped me a lot is I've probably said I don't understand more than other people my job. And I still say that. And it's just, it's okay. It's your money. If you don't understand, say, I don't understand. And just on a complete tangent, my son was studying some physics, and I was talking to his physics teacher, and I would say, I don't understand, and his teacher was able to explain it in terms that I could understand. And in fact, Einstein said you should be able to explain physics to a bartender. So if you can explain physics to a bartender, you should be able to explain finance to an individual investor. We're not asking too much here. So it's okay. If there's only one message to send to an individual investor, it's okay to say, I don't understand it. Can you explain it in more simple terms?
Absolutely. And then one of the things, I mean, I'll take a little time to do a little bit of advertising, but, you know, we, as part of the Future of Finance Project, one of the first pieces of content that came out of that was the Statement of Investor Rights, which basically lays out what an individual investor should expect from a financial service provider or an advisor. And one of those things is, you know, to have that level of communication, you know, and feel confident about the questions that you ask and to get an explanation of their assets in a way that they can understand. So I think that's a great point.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important to just have a handle on your rights and really to have a handle on, I mean, one thing that really struck me about the report that you sent, speaking about I don't understand, you sent over about 100 pages about banks, and in the first 15 pages, I didn't see anything about subprime mortgages. Are we cool with all that stuff? Is that over?
we're on to creating new bubbles. And that's the issue with the banking industry is that, you know, once you have a bubble in one area, you know, it's like after a hurricane, you're putting wood over the windows, and you're making sure you're safe for the next storm, and something else that's going to get you, okay? So after commercial real estate, we talked about Citigroup, but after commercial real estate, early 1990s, you weren't going to have a commercial real estate problem. Then it was the tech bubble, or TMT, as we called it then. And then it was the housing crisis. So it's not going to be housing, okay? It's not all resolved, but we're kind of coming out of it now. It's going to be something else. It's going to be some sort of interest rate risk. If I had to say what, you know, banks, funds, maybe even individuals taking interest rate risk that they shouldn't be taking. And for banks, which get a lot of deposits and then they can invest it long term, you can do all sorts of things. And back in 1994, when the Fed raised rates very quickly, there were all sorts of problems in the financial system. So that's one area. And it has been a couple decades since the last commercial crisis, commercial real estate, or just plain old commercial lending, but it's not going to be housing. It's not going to be subprime.
Do you think they've learned? The lenders have learned. I mean, our lending. I mean, certainly lending guidelines have gotten much more conservative, and it's not like it was before. But you think that's those lending practices of the past are over, or do you think banks will ever? You don't think they'll ever get back into what they were doing before with the 95% loan-to-value mortgages and things like that?
It'll be a new asset category.
Different one.
Student loans. You know, you've seen more about student loans recently. It'll be certain commercial loans to certain subsegments. I will say there hasn't been a whole lot of loan growth the last few years, and that's bad because it can hurt bank revenue growth. It's not a sign of maybe as robust an economy as we need to have. But it's also good because maybe you're not creating as much bubbles this go around as in the past.
Yeah, you're making more conservative loans. People have to have more skin in the game now than they had to in the past, right?
So I think the phrase sustainable capitalism has been used in other references, but to me that's sustainable capitalism. Let's grow at a rate that's sustainable. Yeah. Let's not have these, you know, boom and bust cycles.
Come back for part two next week on insideinvesting.org. Copyright 2013 CFA Institute.